So, first of all, it's great to be back at KITP. I haven't been here, I guess, since 2006. And it's going to be fun to do this Blackboard talk. So I looked at Christina's talk, so I realized I have to sort of not overlap too much. But tell me, I mean, let me just take a sort of poll. How many of you were here for Christina's talk? Oh, good. Okay. And then how many of you are not in the program? Okay, good. In that case, I can probably repeat myself at the risk of boring the folks from the program. So, as with all these Blackboard talks, the idea is to communicate something about our field to people in other programs. I need my glasses, unfortunately, because I can't read my notes. I gave it the title field. I gave it a much more grown-up title earlier. I called it Statistical Field Theories of Active Matter and Large Set. That just wouldn't do. So, possibly this is the slightly prettier title, maybe why so many of you have showed up. So, this is about this thing called active matter. And active matter is about one particular way in which physics enters biology. You know, physics broadly enters biology, you could say, through mechanics and through the processing of information. And this talk is really about the mechanics part. And a fair amount of it is about statistical mechanics in living matter. And you know, eventually it'll be great to have a comprehensive understanding of living matter from mechanics to what happens at a cell surface receptor to the mechanical events which trigger further events and trigger a signaling cascade and so forth. But certainly I am not there yet. Whether other people are, I don't know. And my particular class of problems, as was declared in the title of this, is continuum descriptions of collections of particles that know how to move by themselves. Okay? So the term living is used in a very narrow sense. Living or active means particles which can take up energy, dissipate it, and do some kind of systematic work. Now, you may say that practically any object can do that at some level, and that tells you actually that to this, in this sense, the you know dividing line between living matter and dead matter is a subjective one. Obviously, you know, we're all made of things that obey the laws of physics. I don't know how to write large enough to read without my glasses. So, you know, you can imagine two kinds of systems, ones which actually have some battery or fuel tank on board, and ones which just convert energy directly. You will see toy examples of these. So, what's the motivation for this field other than the general arrogance that physics should be able to understand everything? It is, you know, you pick things that you can understand. So, motivation is use the board economically. There's broadly two kinds of motivations which started this game, which has cohered around the theme called active matter. One is the observation of orientational order of velocities in collections of particles that move, and the other is the mechanics of cell and tissue, of cells and tissue. And you know, these except to the extent that these things are made of these things. You might not think they have that much to do with each other. One of the lessons of this field has been the surprising connections between physics at the scale of a collection of organisms and physics at the scale of a collection of stuff inside a cell, which, again, makes it the kind of subject in which physicists would like to work. The approach that most of the work I talk about today will take tends to be called phenomenological. And this, you know, is continuum mechanics phenomenologically. In principle, whenever you have a treatment like fluid mechanics, which is a continuum treatment, there is the possibility of deriving that from something more microscopic, like kinetic theory or a particulate description. I won't really go into the details of that, although some of the work I'll present is the end result of those kinds of calculations. Okay, so I'll try to focus on this approach. Okay, so the general idea is if you see an organized state of matter, like a flock, you step back, you retain only some essential salient features. So you look at what quantities are conserved, which is all you would do if you were doing ordinary fluid mechanics. But if you're doing the fluid mechanics of systems with long-range order, you look in addition at what symmetries, what continuous invariances are spontaneously broken. And in the event that you're at or at the brink of a continuous phase transition, you look at some variable that's going critical when you tune some parameter. Once you have an adequate description of these, in principle, you can write down equations of motion which describe the long wavelength, long time physics correctly. And that's the spirit in which we approach these problems. Okay, and this is, you know, an approach that has worked very well for dead condensed matter. A dead condensed matter has one great advantage over living condensed matter, which is that it is at thermal equilibrium. So there's many rules; it's nicely constrained. However, you will see it doesn't do so badly even for simple aspects of living matter. And the general approach here is really what you might call equations of motions following from what you might call pure thought, pure unaided reason alone. Okay. An important fact to note about the kinds of systems we're talking about, unlike dead condensed matter, is one invariance which you do not have is time reversal. Because all the systems we're interested in have internal structures which in a sustained way take up and dissipate energy. Okay? And the case we want to study is where you keep supplying them this energy and they keep doing their thing. So that's the mode in which you want to study. You could imagine studying a collection of bugs with limited nutrient and watch them slowly winding down and grind to a halt, but at the moment we won't do that. Those are also, the same equations, if you include nutrient as a dynamical variable, can be made to do that. So this means that detailed balance will not constrain the type of dynamics that we're going to look at. Okay. So what I want to do, and I also want to keep looking at the watch, I already used up 15 minutes.
Big one on the wall.
Thank you. Even better. So now you can do this for systems of increasing complexity. The simplest systems for which this was done is you've got a bunch of critters that can point any old way. So imagine you had a bunch of little vectors. Imagine you had them in two dimensions. So if these things were just little arrows, little pointers, like in an XY model, then even if they were itinerant, so that their interactions might depend on local changes in density, you could get an ordered phase only above two dimensions. Right? If you've got a bunch of little XY vectors in the plane, then even if they're attached to particles which can, you know, shuffle around a little bit, if those particles can at most diffuse, it's some itinerant variant of an XY model. But supposing you had XY spins, whose spins were actually velocity vectors, then you have something very different. First of all, not only is the fact that they're point, in many analyses of models in magnetism, for example, you have a little internal vector. And the fact that that vector is pointing in space in the simplest description of the systems doesn't matter very much. For instance, in the Heisenberg or the XY model, the invariance of the problem is under globally rotating all the spins without having to rotate the lattice. You could worry about introducing spin lattice coupling, but you don't. You still have something interesting. Here, it's not just the fact that these things are pointing in some direction in space. It's the fact that the way they point is the way they move. So you can write down agent-based models, which means models where you have individual particles, and each particle inspects its neighbor and tries to align, and having aligned moves. So basically, align with neighbors and move by following your nose. Align imperfectly. So then this is a model which, as you dial down the level of noise or increase the number of neighbors, goes through a phase transition. And this is called the V-check model. Since my talk is about the field theory, I won't really talk about this aspect. I'll cut straight to the chase. And I know Christina talked about this, but it doesn't matter. The story I've told so far will sort of, you know, light up two parts of your brain. One that says, well, this is like a model of magnetism, so I should write down a vector order parameter and have it order. On the other hand, this is like a fluid, so I should be able to write down a Navier-Stokes equation. So what you do is write down a very weird marriage of the two. And it looks like this. So we could do a very detailed description in which you actually look at the orientation and the particle velocity as separate variables. But in the spirit of what I'm talking about here, I said look at the conserved quantities and look at the broken symmetries. Okay? The conserved quantities only the number of particles. Because I'm considering a bunch of particles moving on a solid surface. That solid surface is a momentum sink. So I can slow down or speed up with respect to that. I have a fixed frame of reference, and it can, I don't have to worry about momentum conservation. So number only. Broken symmetry. Rotation. So I introduce a velocity as the order parameter. And a density, which maybe I'll call rho. The conserved variable, and I'll write down equations of motion. And let me take a simplifying description, which this is the total velocity field of the system. And so this thing obeys a simple continuity equation with respect to that velocity field. And this thing has an equation of motion, which will have two parts. Let me actually erase this. Make room for myself here.
Why is it important to introduce this momentum sink? Why not have it be frictionless and also have...
You could have different kind. I'm trying to take the very simplest model in which there's only one conservation law. I will pass very soon to the case where there is, where you have a bunch of particles in bulk, in which case one of them, they can only slow down or speed up by passing momentum to each other. That introduces interesting complications. This is just the simplest. So So first of all, I'll introduce a parameter here. You may ask me why on earth I'm doing that. And I'll put an ellipsis here, and I will come to why I'm doing that. So what can these particles do? These particles can speed up or slow down with respect to the surface. So there should be a damping of their total velocity.
Minus?
Well, it's a number, right? So I can study it for all values, positive and negative. I'm entitled to treat that as a parameter. After all, even if at the single particle level, the particle has a propulsion speed, just like in an XY Heisenberg model, even if microscopically there is a well-defined moment, you can be in a coarser description, you can be, let's say, in a mean field description on either side of the transition, in which case you have to allow that parameter to move around. So in a coarse grain theory, I just put in a term like that. And I'll put this in, okay? I'll work on both sides with this. This is just saying that the velocity, these particles have a speed limit, okay? Then these particles like to line up with each other or move at the same velocity as each other. So I have some term with a couple of gradients and v. And you can see there's more than one way of writing this. You could have a del squared v, you could have a grad div v, and so forth. Let me not worry about that. You could even worry about whether the damping along the way the particles are pointing and transverse is different. So you can grow increasing complications here. And you can have sort of permitted couplings to the density, the simplest of which might be this. But again, you can have more complicated couplings where the way you couple to density gradients along your pointing direction and transverse can be different.
You assume that the alignment is local in space and time.
Yes,
it could
yes.
Have a time delay.
It could have all of those things, but you know we start. Absolutely. Towards the end of my talk, I'll show you a very interesting set of experiments and simulation and theory about non-local interactions. See, the idea again is that if something is non-local, I'd rather not put it in as a little demon that's doing something. I'd rather have a dynamically variable doing it. If there are processes which take a finite time scale on the resolution of my study, I should introduce a dynamically variable corresponding to those. If something is non-local, there should be a field somewhere corresponding to it. But right now, yeah.
If your lambda is not unity, you lose Galilean invariance.
Yeah, so first of all, remember you don't have Galilean invariance. I already told you, you're doing this on a surface. Okay. Secondly, there are, again, given that this is not a Galilean invariant system, there are two other kinds of terms that can arise. One is a grad of v dot v with some coefficient, and the other is a v times div v. All of these are allowed. Okay, I won't dwell more on them. So losing Galilean invariance costs you all kinds of complication. The other thing which I'm not going to dwell on, but which is a big worry, is that every coefficient in here, in principle, depends on the density and depends on the magnitude of the velocity. Okay, so this problem is fraught with many more complications than the inventors of this model originally realized. So I don't want to say very much about it other than to tell you, therefore, that here is our, and I should do one more thing. A noise, okay? Because it comes from a microscopic rule where each particle can make mistakes. So this is our first continuum field theory of a living fluid. And let me say a word about noise. What's important about noise in non-equilibrium systems is not, it's not that you want to put in funny correlations. Again, if you introduce features with a finite time scale, I would rather you introduce a dynamically variable corresponding to that. If you're going to call something a noise, you should work on time scales long compared to its correlation time. If its correlation time is part of what you can resolve, you should introduce a dynamically variable corresponding to it. What's important about this noise is the way, okay, and it's not even a question of is this noise in agreement with some damping, because this model is so non-equilibrium that it's not really worth the trouble at the moment to look at what the equilibrium limit of this problem would be. If you take a look at this problem, you can see that it's this weird hybrid of a continuous spin model and a fluid dynamic model, right? You clearly couldn't write down a model like this for a bulk fluid. Suppose you had a huge mass of, bees or worms or something. okay, all trying to move. You can't have this term, right? Because Galilean is freely suspended in air, in vacuum. They have oxygen tanks in the back. Or, you know, if you don't worry about the damping of the air. And so you can think of situations where the dynamics has to be quite different from this. So all of this really applies only if you've got a momentum sink. You can do a bunch of things with this. One is just go into the ordered phase and look at the ways in which that ordered phase, meaning take a mean field approach to this. At mean field, you can see that if alpha and beta are greater than 0, then you have a state with, right? And it could point anyway. And you can then ask, does noise kill that state? I will not show you how, but I will just tell you the fact that the velocity, that the order parameter is a velocity and not just a thing that's pointing, means that if you had locally a little disturbance where things are pointing this way, a little while later that disturbance has gone somewhere else. Right? So if you have a region with a bunch of things pointing the same way and a few pointing the other way, those regions clean themselves up a bit because things pointing in different directions have moved out. So that's just a story. You can read Toner and Tu's paper about how this model turns out to have long-range order in two dimensions. Okay, so it defies Hohenberg, Mermin, Wagner, etc. By virtue of the fact that it's not equilibrium, its order parameter is not just pointing somewhere, it's going somewhere, and that changes everything. So I will not do the calculation. But you can imagine, and the techniques we learned at our generalized mother's knees, in fact, help us do those calculations and actually show that it's long-range order. Okay? That aspect of the problem is in pretty good shape. I'll want to move from this problem to another problem, but I'll tell you a couple of things, a couple of properties of this state. If you go into the ordered state, then you can see that, let's say if you're all pointing that way on average, then if locally you point like that and like that or something, then a few seconds later, this region will have a lower density because it's a bit of the velocity pointing that way. A few seconds later, this region will have more density. So you get propagating disturbance, the interplay of the orientation and the density, again, which doesn't happen in equilibrium magnets. You could take an equilibrium, soft spin, compressible magnet. You could have a compressible magnet in which there is a density variable. You could even have, let us say, this coefficient depend on the local density. None of that will give you propagating waves in an XY, classical finite temperature XY magnet. Okay. But this one gets all these cool things. Many of these features, orientationally ordered states, where you've got sort of integral curves of some ordered vector acting as though they're springs, many of the results are reminiscent in some vague way of things like Alfvén waves in magnetized plasmas and so forth. And I'll come to some of that a little later. But what I wanted to say, therefore, the ordered state has wave-like excitations. These wave-like excitations are not like sound waves in ordinary fluid. They're not coming because sound waves, the sound waves which you hear me are a consequence of momentum conservation and mass conservation. These sound waves are a consequence of number or mass conservation and spontaneously broken rotation variance. They're a different kind of sound wave. They're, a flexural wave of this orientation. Okay. They have a funny dispersion relation, actually. See, one of the things to note, there are interesting connections with these kinds of waves. These are waves which arise because you have a moving system. They are a lot like these things that Whittem and Lighthill called kinematic waves. They're not precisely that. In any moving system, if you have a disturbance, the disturbance moves with a speed whose scale is set by the moving speed, but is not necessarily equal to it. These are more complicated than most. Most kinematic wave analyses have to do with propagation only along the direction of motion. You can get stuff that moves laterally and so forth. But in spirit, they're very much like that. And that, yeah?
Speaking of Lighthill and Whittem, yeah. A question I was going to ask, but you went through it. Can you formulate these things relative to a mean speed? In other words, like the game you play in traffic flow.
Yeah, this is with respect to a mean speed.
You have a mean speed that's specified, say, as a function of density, and individuals adjust to it.
So the extent to which any of those things happen is already buried in this. You know, here, for instance, it's physically reasonable to say that the aligning tendency, or the local ordering tendency, or the local magnitude of this moment, depends on the density. That has very, very interesting consequences, which I'll come to in a second. At the simple level of analysis, at the simplest level of analysis, if you give the individual particles a speed which doesn't care about density, already you get all of this. This is a collective effect of the fact that the local tendency to order depends on the number of neighbors. You can decorate that further by making even the preferred speed density dependent. So there's, you know, Christina talked about some of this, I think, in her talk. No, Mike Hagen, the other, whatever. So can't remember, too many talks. But I'm saying that even without that feature, there's already much of the same kind of physics that comes out here. You can then say, OK, this is fine. We've understood some simple properties of the phase. There are more. There's if you have a region with, on average, n particles, then delta, and you just watch that region and look at the density fluctuations, those grow as n to a power bigger than half. Okay, and all of this has to do with the fact that, you know, you've condensed into this ordered phase. Which direction you picked was arbitrary, and therefore long wavelength variations in that direction are very easy. And those long wavelength variations are the, you know, the Nambu-Goldstone mode of this type of order. Unlike in equilibrium systems, those fluctuations pollute the density fluctuations and give you huge density fluctuations. A detailed calculation of what that looks like is another story. The one thing I want to leave you with, one largely unresolved question, although there's been significant progress, is the following. If you take this model within mean field theory, you have a continuous transition. Numerical studies reveal anything but a continuous transition if those studies are done on large enough scales and long enough times. And one of the reasons for that is this density dependence of the local tendency to order. So what happens is if you've got, you know, if you imagine some region in which all of a sudden particles leave because of a fluctuation, that local region itself tends to get disordered, right? Because you don't have enough neighbors. And what you find, in fact, is if you take these equations and you look at this mean field solution, so the mean field homogeneous flock is always linearly unstable, just past onset. So if you've got these guys all moving together like that, with orientational order and no positional order, it's unstable with wave vectors parallel to the ordering direction. So it has a tendency to, and you know, I don't want to do the algebra. You can take these equations. What's crucial is this. The fact the local tendency to order depends on the local density. It gives you a banding instability. Okay, the only thing is the wave number of that banding instability itself goes to zero as you approach the mean field transition. Nevertheless, the point, therefore, is the state that mean field theory offers you as the candidate ordered state is fatally flawed, because right as soon as you enter it, it's not there.
Are there conditions on the functional dependence of alpha for that? It's just generic.
Generic. So that's why, although it was originally discovered by deriving these equations from a microscopic description, it only requires that alpha should depend on rho. It doesn't even matter. You could even have something as idiotic as low-density regions being more willing to order than high-density. Even that doesn't, because alpha squared comes in, right? Alpha prime, the density dependence squared comes in, if I remember right. I think it doesn't. You can call me on this one afterwards and check. Yes.
Yeah,
even something unphysical like being more willing to order when there's less neighbors.
The sign
you can't even escape it by that. Yeah. Okay. So the character of the transition, so people have now begun to understand a lot about it, partly because of that density dependence, partly because of this term. There are features of this problem which look a little bit like the Burgers equation, because you've got a moving state with, you know, this kind of term, which will give you an effective one-way wave speed, which depends on the local degree of order. So that, again, is reminiscent of kinematic waves and burgers and so forth. So on both sides of the mean field transition, you can find shock-like solutions. If you patch those shock-like solutions together with the density dependence, you get a very interesting scenario for the onset. But I would not say there is a theory of the onset of the ordered phase. What there is there are some exact solutions for particular structures. There are very, very precise numerical results and so forth. So this is actually still a very murky area. And all of this is still by either analyzing the particle models, which are stochastic, or the coarse grain models, which people tend to analyze without noise for the most part. Toner and Tu's analysis for long range order, et cetera, was with noise. But noise, OK. Actually, in any system made of particles, the noise in what can we say about the general form of noise strengths? Supposing you have some concentration field, and it obeys a diffusion equation. So supposing you have a bunch of particles, n particles. Forget all this flocking stuff. You have n Brownian particles. Okay, what can you say about the noise? And each particle is moving, doing Brownian motion. It's tempting to say that the continuous concentration field just obeys a diffusion equation. But actually, no, it doesn't. It obeys a stochastic diffusion equation. Just like n quantum particles, if you average them, obey an operator equation for the quantum density. Right? Likewise, this is a stochastic concentration field. Because in a region with n particles on average, you have a noise here of order square root of n. Right? So this actually has a noise which looks something like the square root of the concentration times a vector white noise. So even a stochastic description of n independent, non-interacting Brownian particles has a multiplicative. So multiplicative noise is not an exotic thing. Multiplicative noise is inevitable because it's just telling you that fluctuations in extensive quantities are of order square root n, and fluctuations in intensive quantities are of order 1 over square root n. If instead of this you wrote down an equation for the mean local orientation, you get a 1 over root concentration. This is true not just of active systems, but of anything. It's probably evidence for the existence of God or something that this didn't completely destroy everything that people have done in dynamically critical phenomena. For some reason, it looks like it doesn't matter in those problems. I'm not suggesting. I'm just trying to provoke you. Okay. No, what I'm saying is it's interesting that the fact that noise in all these systems is multiplicative didn't come and bite us in problems that we studied in time-dependent StatMech earlier is curious. Here, it may well matter because if you look at numerical study of this model, when you look at density inhomogeneities that appear spontaneously, they are not ones in which you've got a mean density riding on which you have an undulation. You have density fluctuations where some regions have none of the particles and some regions have all of the particles. So density fluctuations. So multiplicative noise may be something that we have to deal with rather more severely in active systems, which is a bit of a pain. We don't have too many analytical techniques for dealing with multiplicative noise in stochastic PDEs. Nonlinear stochastic PDEs. Even the proud boast of people with my kind of upbringing, that you give me a problem, I'll write down the coarse grain theory, and at worst, there'll be some technical reason why I can't solve it. Even that is questionable in the sense that in many of these problems, finally, if you want to solve it, you may be condemned to go back to the particle model, which is terribly disappointing from my point of view, because the talk was called field theory. It wasn't called particle theory. Okay, so noise is an issue. I won't say more about it.
Does varying the dimensionality help or not really make any difference?
Haven't thought about whether it'll help the noise problem.
The stability you're talking
about. The banding instability exists in all dimensions.
If your lambda is not unity, you can have V and space having different dimensionalities. You don't care about the linear invariance now anymore. So you can have space dimensionality large and V finite.
No, but you could do that, but then you'd be divorcing these things from their actual context. These are after, no, okay. What
so
you can
you
have
it did by Lagrangian of unity. It means that you don't have Lagrangian trajectories. Your R dot is not V, right?
R dot can be V because the continuity equation at the particle, the continuity equation is still an identity. The variable I'm choosing to describe the oriented state is still the velocity. So the difficulty is not that. The difficulty really is this, that if you want a complete description, you should start with an orientation field and a velocity field and a density field. Of the two, orientation and velocity, one you can treat a slave to the other and get the effective equations. And when you do that, you will find that even if you start with a fluid, imagine starting with a bulk fluid, okay, with Galilean invariance and no active processes. Now introduce an orientation field and make it carry the kinds of stresses that I'll tell you about in a few minutes. You can derive an effective equation of motion for velocity and density or orientation and density, which will contain terms of this sort, who with a dual origin, one just inherited from Galilean invariance, the other coming from some of the stresses created by the orientation field. So if you like, there are inertial stresses and there are actually active stresses. And in some situations, they combine to give you that. So this is probably taking me into active matter nerd land. Which only three people in the room will care about. I'm supposed to stop at 1:15?
Yeah.
Wow, okay. Then I will, I think then what I'll do is I'll probably skip many things I was going to say and tell you about one. Yeah, I think there are several things I won't talk about. Let me just cut to one last thing. So the other things I wanted to talk about are so if you have a collection of active particles in a fluid, then you must respect momentum conservation. So then the main thing that will happen is, let's introduce a different thing. Let's introduce the total momentum density. Let's introduce the total number density. Let's separately introduce the concentration of active particles. And let's introduce an orientation field. So then, these three obey conservation laws. This is the variable which is going to reflect what symmetry is broken. And you can build what you can call the liquid crystal hydrodynamics of active particles. I won't do it in detail. I'll just say two things. One is you will have active stresses, and you'll have active particle currents. So you'll have, phenomenologically, you can see that, OK, the stress is a second-rank symmetric object. Nothing forbids me to write down a stress which is bilinear in my orientational order parameter field. And nothing forbids me to write down a current which is proportional to P. And this is physically very reasonable. It just says if you've got a bunch of particles oriented that way, then they will move that way. You can put these together into a hydrodynamic treatment which resembles the hydrodynamics that's well established for pneumatic liquid crystals, but with various differences. One, effects have to do with polarity is important. Two, the kinds of flows that this generates and the kinds of mass fluxes that this generates give you very different physics from the equilibrium systems. Very simply, you know that if you had a liquid crystal condensed into an oriented phase with everybody pointing the same way, if it's a thermal equilibrium, it's still a liquid. Therefore, the orientation can be anisotropic. The stress will be isotropic. Pascal's law. If it's a thermal equilibrium liquid. In these systems, a local orientation in one direction means a local anisotropic stress in that. So you get contributions to the deviatoric stress. In the stationary state, you have a non-zero deviatoric stress. It's as though it's a medium in which I had put on some external field. The big difference is because I didn't put on the field, that direction can vary. And interesting dynamics ensues. including instabilities. The obvious ordered states of liquid crystals are all unstable here. So if you have a whole bunch of things pointing this way, if you had a whole bunch of things all pointing this way, then imagine a perturbation. Let's say these are two walls, and imagine that everybody is on average pointing that way. And imagine a perturbation where locally something points like this. Then you can see that the stresses carried by these particles will push fluid that way and push fluid this way if the stresses are contractile. So that simple orientationally ordered states are destabilized. Okay, so if the system is made of, you know, there's a coefficient here, which is the strength of the forcing. Its magnitude tells you how strong it is. Its sign tells you whether it's pulling in along the axis. Sorry, I'm summarizing many years of work, some of which some of you have heard before. Generically, you can imagine if you have a uniaxial stress, it pulls in along the main axis or pushes out along the main axis. If it does what an alga does when it swims, or it does what a bacterium does when it swims, those two give rise to two kinds of instabilities. And so forth. So the whole story of this, which I will not go into. What I want to, I should have said right at the beginning, I should give you a plug for my favorite review articles on this subject. That's one. So a lot of the detail can be found in these various review articles, which are my favorite because I'm an author of them.
Is there a statistical steady state when there's interest
yes.
in some way?
Then yeah, so what happens, numerical studies find a weird kind of turbulence. It's a turbulence not driven by the interplay of Reynolds number and thing. The relevant dimensionless number is it's important. So these are active systems, and basically, if I replace this concentration by its mean, I have a scale of stress, which is the typical work done in a cycle of the swimming stroke or whatever it is, the organism, times the concentration. So these are systems endowed with a characteristic scale of stress. Therefore, for a given viscosity, they're endowed with a characteristic time scale. And in an unbounded system, everything happens in this time scale. In a bounded system, there's a competition between elasticity and active processes that limit it. But this is actually very important because, you know, many, many features, like what kind of typical flow rates you get if you confine an active fluid, what is the time it takes for the final stages of cell division to take place. So in the fact that roughly speaking, the fact that big and small cells of a given type seem to divide in about the same time is closely associated with this idea. Time scale of confined flows. So these are all systems with a characteristic time scale. OK, so now I should actually move to something completely different. Not really different, actually. So one of the things that's fun to do is to study active matter in very controlled situations. You can do it either by reconstituted biological systems, or you can try to imitate it with completely artificial components. Those of you who were at Surapriya's talk, let me say one more thing. These kinds of ideas can be applied not only in bulk fluid, not only in simple confined geometries, but also imagine, let us say, you have a membrane, cell membrane, a fluid membrane, in contact with an active fluid. You can build the effective hydrodynamics of a membrane by this interplay. This is something I will not have time to talk about, but one of the authors is in the audience.
Two of them.
Two of the authors are in the audience. Yeah. Yes. Three of the authors are in the room. Sorry. OK, so I will not talk more about this. Ananya and Pragya can tell you about it. Imitations, you can have chemically propelled colloids. Some of you heard Surapriya's talk. you can have something even simpler. So this, you know, this is an almost silly imitation. Imagine you have a surface, and this is side view, and you have particles lying on it. And imagine you vibrate the surface up and down. Of course, it's not really self-driven, but if you think of each particle lying on the surface as an object with an internal degree of freedom, namely the tilt of the particle with respect to the horizontal, and you vibrate it, and you take into account the fact that the particle has some contact mechanics with the surface, you can produce, as people who were at Arshad Kudroli's talk will remember, you can produce particles that walk.
Okay.
And I'll tell you a little story about those. Movie, yeah. Essentially just a movie. Yes. The rest I'll just do on the board, no problem. The question is, where is the... It is coming out. So what I'll show you a bunch of these things. So there's a few movies, not one movie, but they're all movies. I won't show you any equations from here. Start. So this, I'll tell reasons for the funny geometry I'll tell you later. These are little tapered rod-like particles, about 5 millimeters long, strewn amongst a bunch of beads about a millimeter in diameter. So this whole thing you're viewing from the top, this is a system that's vibrating up and down, that is to say vibrating perpendicular to the screen. And what you see is that you see two things. One is you see that there's this, that these particles are indeed moving around. Two is you see that they move around everywhere, but nothing, no drama. Finally, it doesn't order or anything. Okay?
Is data not simulation? I mean,
this is an experiment. Yeah.
And so this is in a solution of beads?
Yeah, there's no water.
No, but these are beads.
Beads, yeah. You don't, I mean, the beads are not essential for endowing the polar rods with their motility. The beads are essential for what's going to follow in the talk.
Is it purely 2D?
Well, it depends on what you mean. The point is the experimental system is a height slightly bigger than the diameter of the rods, but much smaller than two rod diameters. There's some room to move up and down. It's just so that stuff doesn't fly out of the container. You could probably do the same thing without a lid, but then they might sit on, they might perch or other things. So you don't do that. And so now the only thing you change, you keep the concentration of rods the same, and you increase only the concentration of beads. You don't need to increase them to the point shown here where they're starting to form crystals. This picture happens to have that. And as you wait and watch, you will find that they organize themselves into an ordered state. Admittedly, because the annoying features of the real world, where you don't have periodic boundary conditions in all directions, these things form a parallel structure at the walls. So in order to escape this limiting feature of the real world, so this work, by the way, is Nitin, who's Ajay Sood's student, and we decided to...
There's some critical point where...
Yeah, yeah, so I'll show you all that. There is a, this, yeah, yes,
to expel the rods.
So we haven't found any place where they expel the rods, really. So here is a simulation with periodic boundary conditions, and the bead concentration is high enough, but we've designed a simulation which tries to imitate as many of the parameters of the experimental system as possible. The only thing is the experimental system, the surface has imperfections that give you angular noise. The computer surface doesn't, and so you have to introduce a little bit of noise.
Your second video had all the rods on the boundary.
That's because there was a boundary. So I could have shown you that. I just decided, I said it was annoying that there is a boundary. You know, this is borderless science. Sorry. and you will see that little by little, they enter an ordered state. Once they enter it, they won't leave. So. And you know, it's important to note that these things are not ordering because they're bumping into each other. If you increase the rod concentration a lot, they could order because of steric effects. The steric effects here are rather indirect, and they have to do with what the rods do to the beads and what the beads do to the rods. As you were asking about the concentrations of various things, I don't think I can switch off this. Just a second. Wrong.
Were they ordering in front of us or not?
They were. But did I not show it for long enough?
Well, enough for me. I mean, they're moving down, right? Or what?
Yeah, sorry. They were ordering. I could have. I have a bunch more movies, but I wanted to stick to the blackboard format as far as possible. So really what ends up happening...
They were flocking.
They were really flocking. Yeah. So this... And you can do the whole thing in considerable detail. What you find roughly is that if this is... You end up roughly having, you know, it's more or less like a total budget constraint of amount of beads and rods. And on this side, it's isotropic. On this side, it's ordered. I make no claims as to the nature, the character of the transition. These are fairly small systems. But there's a pretty well-defined phase transition. Within the resolution of the computer simulations and the experiments, there are considerable pre-translational fluctuations. You can measure two-point correlations of the orientation, and you get a considerable increase in correlation length. You get a reasonably nice onset. But I mean, it's not as though we've done finite size scaling. It's not as though we've done monster simulations to check the nature of the transition. There is some indication that many features of the ordered phase near onset are a little bit like what you see in other flocking systems. So, but it's a really cool system. The question is, what's happening? Why is it ordering?
Are the beads and rods?
Tell me again?
Are the beads and rods the same material?
No, the beads are bought from a costume jeweler, and the rods are a trade secret. We don't make them. We get them from somewhere, and I don't want to spoil Nitin's... it's probably mentioned in the paper.
There are big density
differences? It helps that the density is substantially different. I think the rods are copper and the beads are aluminum. Yeah, it helps that the beads be well moved by the rods. That does help.
You're making a toy, I presume,
in the end. Yeah, I was kind of hoping to make something that, you know, that will ship pharmaceuticals on large scales. I think you can do all kinds of stuff. I don't, you know. This thing is so cool that... we are wondering what we can do with it.
Sorry, Sriram, could you tell us a little bit more about numbers in that little sketch you just drew? Because that dashed line is not presumably corresponding to area fraction 1.
No, not at all. Numbers.
I mean,
yeah, just a second. I have to look at my notes, as it were.
What sort of area fractions?
Bead area fractions, you need, you know, somewhere here is probably 50%. Down here is probably the rod area fractions are really you don't need high rod area fractions to achieve this, you know, maybe 20% or something like that. I can just
okay.
So then one of the nice things is the rods are very, very far from each other almost all the time. So there's a kind of hydrodynamic effect of a weird kind. It's dry particles on a dry solid surface. You would think that their momentum didn't travel that far, but the point is that as you increase the concentration of the beads, the beads rub much more against each other than against the base. And unlike in a layer of confined fluid, you have two different damping mechanisms for the momentum of a given bead, which is what damps its momentum when it bumps into the top and bottom walls is different from, you know, you have two separate control parameters, something one that's more like a viscosity and one that's more like a friction with the walls.
So,
yeah.
If I understand this plot, then the phase transition, of course, also in the absence of rods.
It's really difficult to ask about the, you know, a few important things. Suppose you had no rods.
Right.
These beads do nothing. They bounce up and down in place. See, you know, in order to move, you need to be able to tilt. A sphere can't tilt.
So that line actually will at a point left.
Yeah, so, you know, it gets harder and harder when you have three rods in the system. It gets much harder to say anything intelligent. So I don't want to commit myself over here. So I'm saying here, actually, this is rods, right?
Yeah.
So over here, it's a little hard to commit oneself as to exactly what happens. It seems to go up, but clearly you need to do much better studies. What you need is studies with a huge number of particles but a very, very small concentration. That's the kind of thing that a computer simulation can try to answer. And over here, as you put in lots of rods, the rods bump against each other and form ordered locks. But actually, the state of order is much cleaner when the rods aren't bumping into each other. So we've not explored either extreme very much. And in the experimental system, we also the reason for the scalloped boundary is a trick by Olivier Dauchot and group, who showed that if you do that, then stuff doesn't pile up at the walls. In some talk the other day, in Mike Hagan's talk, if I remember right, talked about self-propelled particles going to the boundary and getting stuck. You can get out of that by this trick, something that Dauchot and company showed. So we just slavishly imitated.
So ordered space has no instabilities, or?
I haven't explored it very deeply. You know, some of the movies. No, okay, very important. Please note that this is a monolayer in contact with solid surfaces. So it's not a momentum conserving system. So all the instabilities of bulk active fluids will be mitigated by the very close presence of walls. This is like a 2D fluid. First of all, it's one layer thick. And you have, I'm saying basically your hydrodynamic interaction is heavily screened by the presence of walls. Moreover, this monolayer of beads is not incompressible, it's quite compressible. So it's not even like the work by Bartolo, by Paris group, on a monolayer with beads subject to a vertical electric field where they roll and flock. At a coarse grain level, you write down the equations of motion, they're similar, but the mechanics in detail is interestingly different. So if you watch one of the granular movies, it looks like there may be some undulation, wandering instability. Haven't really pushed it, so we don't know. I mean, there's sort of, obviously, there's many things you can look for here, not all of which we have, most of which we're not. Yeah?
Should we make like the beads, like squishy beads or soft one? Do you keep anything or you...
Je sais pas. So, you know, the thing is that I think honest answer is I don't know what will happen if we put in other kinds of particles. They need to be able to transfer their moment. So what's really important, what's interesting about this system is this, that unlike in particles suspended in a fluid, we have a knob to turn. That is, you can have a situation where the way in which the beads lose momentum to the top and bottom surfaces is controlled by a direct interaction. And the way they transfer momentum to each other is controlled by their concentration, the apparent viscosity. And it's not a layer of fluid. It is, I mean, it's not a layer of fluid. It's a 2D monolayer. And so the hydrodynamics is interestingly different. So you can measure many things. You can measure, even in the experiment, but better in the simulation, if you have one rod moving like this, you can measure the velocity field as a function of distance from the rod. There's two things you can measure. Basically, you have one rod moving along. You can ask how much velocity does it induce in its neighborhood. It turns out it induces an appreciable velocity for a respectable distance, many rod thicknesses. That's one part. The other part, so basically, moving rod, that is velocity of beads. Now, the second part of the story is more interesting, because it says, so supposing there's a rod here sitting, pointing the wrong way, what will the flow do? I've got a bead flow like that induced by these guys. On symmetry grounds, I actually don't know. I only know that it will rotate the rod one way or another. But pure thought can't tell me which way it'll rotate it. Because that might depend on this rod is kind of, it's sitting on a surface, it's fat at one end, skinny at another end. You know, is it pivoted near its back? Is it pivoted near its front? You can imagine this guy turning to point that way, which will give you an aligning interaction. Or you could imagine, at least on pure symmetry grounds, it turning to point the wrong way.
If the velocity field of the beads decreases as
yes,
you go
yes.
away, then it is the opposite direction of orientation.
So out to the distance where the induced velocity is appreciable, it's the same sign. So it's interesting. It's important to note that when you take a fluid, you take a self-propelled particle and confine it. A bulk self-propelled particle is a force dipole. A self-propelled particle between two walls is a screened monopole. Therefore, the character of the flow field around one self-propelled particle moving through a medium with walls is rather different than what you have in bulk. And that's an important ingredient here, because one particle propelling itself through a fluid is a slightly asymmetrical four-roll mill. One particle crawling over a surface produces a rather different velocity. And that's actually important here. And how much it influences the neighbors actually depends on how viscous the medium is. It drags them. So what you find, in fact, is that these guys turn the right way, as it turns out. And you can make a fairly, you can then write down a hydrodynamic, you can write down a field theory of living fluids. You can write down a theory of the concentration, the velocity, and the orientation. And now it's actually important to keep these two, and then eventually, let's say, slave this to this. And you'll have a DTV going as, if there's a local polarization, you get a velocity. If there's a local velocity, you get a reorientation. The magnitudes and signs of these go, and you know, you get a bunch of other stuff, which I'm not writing down. The magnitudes and signs of these guys tell you about the, what happens. And for the right sign, you get a transition. You can actually put this in, and you can measure these coefficients from single from simulation studies with some accuracy, and you can rationalize the phase diagram more or less. But I just want to close with one remark. This thing is like a weather vane. You know, you've got the weathercock pointing that way, the wind blows that way, and it turns to point. It's that kind of physics. If you had a bulk fluid, you have one fish. If you have one fish in a bulk fluid, it can't turn to point parallel to the velocity. Galilean invariance renders that meaningless. It can only respond to velocity gradients. Here you've got a velocity with respect to a specified frame of reference, namely the substrate. Therefore, you can have these terms. So there's sort of nice lessons in symmetry and so forth. And lastly, I guess, this is an active effect. It comes from the fact that these polar objects are self-propelling. This is actually just a plain old hydrodynamic effect, effect of hydrodynamics of a particle on a surface. So I'll close with that and take questions.
Is the order stable then? I mean, in these equations, or that's not clear?
In these equations, there's no, I should distinguish. In bulk active fluids with no walls at all, at long enough length scales, that order is guaranteed to be unstable. These equations don't have that property. The order is, there's no intrinsic instabilities in the order.
So they could be stable.
Yeah. In this, in this problem, important thing to note is that unlike in a bulk fluid, the damping here is not momentum conserving. The damping here is damping momentum to the substrate. It's like taking a 2D fluid with a huge Ekman friction or something for the ambient air. And that tends to kill most of those things. So the underlying mechanisms that drive phenomena like turbulence in these systems are likely to be different. Even in the bulk active fluid, the competition is not a Reynolds number. The competition is between the characteristic time scale associated with active stresses and the orientation relaxation time. It's a little bit more like elastic turbulence and pneumatic turbulence and so forth. So in this problem, we haven't, I think this problem, the speeds at this point are slow enough that weird instabilities are not happening. If those instabilities happen, I don't know. I mean, at least the experimental system appears to be in the regime where it actually makes a nice stable flock. And the presence of walls really kills all the annoying instabilities of the bulk system. Jeremy had a question.
In the experiment, you have the impression that there's a flower shape, making like grain boundaries, and actually all your rods, you have the impression that they align through the grain boundaries.
No, no, so what we have, so we have tried to, the best case, the best movies were in that case. We can produce the same kind of order when the medium, the bead medium is liquid. We can, whereas, you know, has not, we can also choose two sizes of beads and make an amorphous. So we, we can stay away from crystallinity. The crystalline case is interesting because actually you have another ordering variable in the problem. We haven't pushed that very far. We haven't tried to understand very hard what happens. But that's okay. So I don't know right now.
Sir, just trying to understand a little better the meaning of active.
Yeah.
So the thought that active has to do with presence, or sort of generation of sort of non-Markovian behavior in there, so the presence of a memory in some way, right? In your example, right, this memory seemed to reside in the state of the beads, right? For example, they were getting to be more or less ordered. Now, going back to the
First I would say, let me just make...
Hold on,
okay,
maybe I'll... And on On this board, you have this lambda that got to be an arbitrary parameter because the Galilean invariance is gone. But I'm sort of wondering if there is another sort of place where this lambda enters, and that is Lagrangianness of motion. Right? So in some other active media, say with birds or whatever, right, your active element is actually Lagrangian. So then the question is, could it conceivably actually make a difference whether, right, you're sort of describing two different systems, right? You're flocking birds, which have the memory, which is integrating the history along a Lagrangian path, versus this other system with a very Eulerian kind of a memory, which is sitting in the bouncing balls.
So I don't know. No, first of all, remember that these particles are self-propelled even without the beads. I showed you the stuff with the beads because very interesting physics happens with
brainless.
The beads. They are brainless.
They have no internal states.
No, but I mean, It's not. It's not. No. So I want to distinguish. First of all, when I say active, I only mean endowed with an internal degree of freedom, which can transduce sort of fairly arbitrary energy inputs into systematic. That's already enough to do these phenomena. No, I mean, you can call active what you like, but like Humpty Dumpty, a word means precisely what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less.
The bowl is segue to wine and cheese discussion.
So but we can fight later.
Hopefully simpler question, but yeah. The dashed line here.
Yeah.
I was sort of hoping that maybe you'd write down an expression for it. I can appreciate that might be impossible, but what quantities in the system that you change does force it to move, and do you understand why that is?
Yeah, so if you like, the degree to which a given moving rod perturbs the surrounding fluid by producing a velocity, that's this part of the story. And that is a sort of frictional coupling of rods to neighboring beads and the beads to each other. That's one. Okay. This is the degree to which a given imposed flow reorients the rods. So those in these.
And there is none in this problem, though. There's no imposed flow.
No, no, but I'm saying you can calculate these now. After all, once you write down equations of motion, whether the flow that a given rod is feeling was put in by you or induced by other particles. I'm saying you can measure these from the simulation by actually putting in a flow and measuring the orientation. And those are quantities that are particle properties. So we're able to trace these coefficients to particle properties whose density dependencies we can measure in the simulation and would have to do some kind of kinetic theory to calculate.
You said the rods are tilted, right?
A little bit. I mean, they're...
Actually, when you project down, you have vector order, not
correct.
Orientation.
This is vectorial order. The whole analysis. No, it's orientation, but it's polar orientation order. It's not a trace. I didn't talk about the... So interestingly, if you try this stuff with apolar rods, nothing interesting happens. But maybe we haven't looked.
I think it's a good point to start. We'll continue it. Thank you.